the commitment of Sean Shulpius at State Shulpius. Now, as the council know, but I will tell the students who are here and the others, yesterday we were advised that there's been a change in the status of this case and a request by the state for a dismissal. And so what we are going to discuss today is not the merits of the case as originally presented, but issues of mootness, the authority of the trial court to enter another order, and as well as your understanding of the meaning of the trial court's decision, and the effect of the pending United States Supreme Court decision on this case and its effect on a dismissal or a delay or whatever. So we will begin with Assistant Attorney General Warren Weinstein.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Warren Weinstein. I'm Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. I guess the best thing, especially for our audience, would be a brief procedural history of this case. In August of 1997, the Circuit Court determined, after hearing evidence, that Mr. Shulpius, although he was a sexually violent person and subject to commitment, was appropriate for supervised release. The trial court had entered an order earlier than August of 97, in which, based on an erroneous reading of the statute, the court had ordered Mr. Shulpius placed someplace other than WORC. The trial court's view of the statute has since been repudiated by the Court of Appeal in State versus Miller. The only bearing that has on the case is there's some slight dispute about exactly when the supervised release order was entered. It is clear that the early order was a decision that Mr. Shulpius did not need to be at WRC, but it also was not a supervised release order, for whatever that's worth. State proceeded under the statute and the court's order to attempt to place Mr. Shulpius, and through a number of attempts was unsuccessful in doing that. Mr. Shulpius brought a motion to dismiss the commitment based on his double jeopardy, ex post facto, and substantive due process claims, and also claiming a violation of the statute. The trial court eventually, after a series of hearings, granted his motion to dismiss. I say that advisedly because the trial court didn't dismiss the commitment, but only ordered Mr. Shulpius released from WRC. The state then filed
WRC
a motion.
WRC is what, Wisconsin Resource Center?
Yes.
Okay.
Which is the current placement for all of the persons committed under Section 980.
And that's a maximum, if we were using gender words, which we don't use. Okay, what is it?
When it was a prison, prior to its transfer over to the Department of Health and Family Service, it was classified as a medium security prison.
Okay.
But it has undergone changes since then. I understand that the new facility at Sandridge has both maximum and medium facility.
Okay.
Security. In any event, after that order was entered, the state filed a petition to appeal a non-final order, which the Court of Appeals granted. After briefing, this court granted Mr. Shulpius's motion to bypass the Court of Appeal. And that's where we were until Thursday of this week, when the trial court acted on a motion which the state designated below, as I understand it. I've not seen the record, but from talking to the district attorney, I understand it was a motion for reconsideration, and that was based apparently on a one of the periodic examinations that's required under 980.07. And the trial court issued a decision on Thursday morning granting the state's request for reconsideration and ordering Mr. Schilfius committed to Wisconsin Resource Center, which, of course, prompted the state's filing of the what I denominated the notice of voluntary dismissal, because that's the language of the rule. It is, of course, subject to this court's acceptance of it under 809-63.
Now, he has been in the Wisconsin Resource Center all this time.
Yes.
So there was a order to have him under different kind of conditions, but that order has never been put into effect.
That's right. The trial court stayed the order releasing him from WRC pending the appeals. So he has remained at WRC the entire time.
Okay.
And that's where we are now.
All right.
With the court's permission, I guess I would first want to address the authority of the circuit court to entertain the quote motion for reconsideration, close quote. Section 808.075 provides for actions that the circuit court can take despite the pendency of an appeal. There are two subsections in that statute that I think come into play in this case. One is subsection 4H, which specifically refers to commitment, supervised release, recommitment, and discharge under sections 980.06, 08, 09. And by incorporating 09, that section by its terms incorporates 07 also, because there's a requirement that if the person does not sign some waiver papers, then the trial court must consider under 07 that requirement is. And if the trial court, if the person doesn't sign those waiver papers under 07, then under section 980.09, the trial court must make certain determinations. So that subsection is specific to 980 litigation. Then there's also section 808.07 sub 1, which authorizes a trial court to consider motions filed under 806.07. There are two subsections under 806.07 which may come into play in this case. One is 806.07.1b, which authorizes the trial court to relieve a person of a judgment or order based on newly discovered evidence under 805.15.3. We're weaving our way through every statute and every rule.
Which one are you relying on?
Well, I haven't seen the records. My best guess at this point is that it was a motion under 806.07, either 1B or 1H. 1H is kind of a catch-all, which says for any other just reason that justifies.
Not under 980.
Well, all of the sections. Well, let me back up a minute. There are very few specific procedures in Chapter 980 dealing with the procedure in circuit court, and as a result of that. And of two reported decisions of the Court of Appeals, the normal rules of civil procedure in 801 through 847 apply to these cases. And this court, while never having directly addressed that, have affirmed or looked at some of those cases that have applied those rules of civil procedure in prior cases. So it's never been specifically
addressed. As I understand this, the reason for the motion for reconsideration, basically this was just a periodic review because of the time factor, as far as you know. In other words, the newly discovered evidence would have to be what the psychiatrist or whatever told the court after this examination?
Without having seen the record,
that's my assumption.
My understanding was that a periodic examination under 980.07 prompted the district attorney to file a motion for reconsideration.
Okay.
And I noticed that although the circuit court also does not specifically mention it, he does refer on a couple of occasions to evidence from a psychiatrist whose name I have not seen in the record before. So I'm assuming that that was the source of the
information. Now, just tell me again what under 808 you're relying on.
I'm sorry?
What provision under 808 you're relying on?
Well,
808 what? 07.
808.075, sub 4 or sub 1. I think some of these motions, and especially without seeing it, may be difficult to characterize. We are still proceeding, because this is an old case, we are still proceeding under commitment under 808.06. The court has never approved a supervised release placement, which is provided for in 980.06. That statute has since been moved into 980.08, but for purposes of this case, it's still in effect. So
you're not really looking under 980.
I'm sorry?
You're not looking for your...
No, the authority is... There's no specific...
There's nothing. Okay, that was my...
Yes, there's no specific...
So I wanted to know what exactly you're proceeding.
That's correct. There's nothing specific in 980 that addresses reconsideration or anything like that. I think you have to, given the procedure and given the ongoing nature of these things, I think we can certainly expect that there's going to be activity in the circuit courts during the pendency of the appeals. For instance, Mr. Miller, who both counsel and I argued last term, at the time we argued, had a case at every level. This court, the Court of Appeal, and in the trial court, all of them surrounding supervised release issues, commitment issues, and things like that. Because of the ongoing nature of these and the fluidity of the mental condition and the assessments of dangerousness, we tend to get, or almost every time there's a reexamination, one side or the other files something in the circuit court and seeks to litigate based on the updated condition of the committed person. And I think that's the reason I think the legislature put in 4H in 808.075. But I think it also would qualify it, despite what the district attorney might have labeled the motion, it would qualify as a relief from judgment under 80607 also. So that's, and I'm not, and I, in any way, because I haven't seen the record, I'm not indicating that the trial court correctly determined that the evidence qualified as new evidence or that this may not have been a continuation of commitment under 980.06. I'm merely saying, in my view, this provides the trial court with the statutory authority to entertain the motion. It may still have been that, based on the evidence, the court should not have acted under that, but that we can't tell without the record.
So as to the question of the trial court's authority, the answer is maybe, from the state's...
I think definitely it has the authority to entertain the motion. I would say whether it properly entertained the motion is where the maybe comes.
Okay. Where does that leave the court, Mr. Weinstein?
Well, I think what that does, we, of course, appealed from the non-final order that released Mr. Schilpius, and the new order, correctly or not, now places him back there. So we have gotten all the relief that we could have gotten from this appeal.
But don't we have a problem of whether he was rightfully held for the 2 or 3 years?
That's correct, and that could come up in two ways, either on the appeal from This I take to be a final order, the new order by the circuit court. It can be raised in that proceeding, or alternatively, Mr. Shilpius would have an action under Section 1983 in either state or federal court for damages for being wrongfully held, if, in fact, the continued commitment at WRC was unconstitutional.
Explain to me how it could come up whether or not he was lawfully held within the last 2 or 3 years, how it could come up if this present order entered by Judge Franke is appealed.
Well, first way it could come up, you mean on the appeal from the final order?
I mean on the appeal from the order entered earlier this week by
yes.
Judge Franke.
Okay. In my view, that's a final order. Now, I think Mr. Shilpius could still say, wait a minute, I have this claim about the conditions or lack of release under supervised release, which render the statute unconstitutional either on one of three theories, and that the appropriate remedy based on that was, and I take it to be that this was at least in part the argument in the circuit court and has been on appeal also, the appropriate remedy was an absolute discharge or dismissal of the commitment proceeding. If that is true, and I would have to put in another caveat, because now that we have a final order, the judge's initial determination of whether supervised release is appropriate would be before that, before the appellate court, which at this point I don't think it is. But assuming that that would be correct, that he was entitled to supervised release. He was entitled to supervised release in August of 97 when the trial court entered that order, then if the appropriate remedy for the unconstitutional or statutory violation of holding him in WRC is dismissal of the petition, I fully expect that he's going to argue that he's entitled to have the petition dismissed on appeal. And we take the position that that's not the remedy, but if it is, certainly, well, the fact that he takes the position that it is going to require an appellate court to address it.
Why is this a final order and the other one not a final order?
Well, because for two reasons. First of all, because of the language of the order itself, which, by the way, the Court of Appeals held was a non-final order, so we've got law of the case in this here. But because of the language of the order itself, Judge Franke contemplated continuation of attempts to place Mr. Shilpius on supervised release, and he did, in fact, hold a contempt hearing for the Department of Health and Family Services. And I think the second reason is based on the statutory structure. Once the determination that supervised release is appropriate is made, there, as this court decided in Sprosty, there is a procedure set forth in the statute that requires involvement of the circuit court in terms of approval of the placement and insurance that there be adequate treatment and those sorts of things. So that continuing process given a supervised release order makes the order placing the person on supervised release non-final. And then, of course, his decision on the dismissal was merely for release. He specifically said the Mr. Shilpius will remain a committed person under 980.05 and be subject to the order of the court. So on that basis, I think the Court of Appeals determined that the order from which the state appealed currently was non-final.
It seems to me none of these orders are final since they can all be reviewed again.
Except for an actual commitment to WRC, I think that's correct.
That's reviewable too?
Well, yeah, that's reviewable. That's a final order.
But changeable, modifiable in the sense that...
It's modifiable in the sense that the prisoner has the right to file a petition for supervised release. The prisoner, the mentally ill person has the right to file a petition for supervised release.
Don't view that as a concession.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
If we make the same mistake, you should not view that as a decision.
Yes, some of my colleagues would be quite upset.
No, they're more amused, I think, from their faces. Mr. Weinstein, what does...
But the person has the committed person has the opportunity to file a petition for supervised release, a petition for discharge. Even if the order is for supervised release, there's provision in there for the department to request that the supervised release be terminated based on either violations of conditions or, I think the language is broad enough to comprehend, a reexamination that shows that supervised release is inappropriate.
What do you think the judge meant on page 6 of his conclusion? For the reasons set forth above, it is hereby ordered that the state's motion for reconsideration is granted, and the order for supervised release is vacated. And I'm assuming that if the person had been on supervised release and had done something improper, that that order might read the same way, that we're terminating supervised release.
Yeah,
right?
it certainly could.
Okay. Then it is further ordered that Chopius is be committed to institutional care pursuant to 980.06. Then here's the language I really am looking at. Still subject, comma, however, comma, to the decision and order requiring release entered in this case on October 27, 1999.
I was hoping you wouldn't ask me that question because I'm not sure I know. Because it seems to me what that sentence says is, I am vacating my order committing him or releasing him, or I'm committing him subject to my order releasing him. And I don't know how you can do that from a practical matter.
Well, as I read the materials, and it seemed to me that what he was saying, but this is a question to you, and it will be to defense counsel, that he got new and further information.
I think that's right.
That is a new report by Dr. Sachsenmeier. And that report was as of that date, which was...
Whenever the reexamination.
September, October of 2000, right? Just a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
She sees him then, right? She's not relying on old stuff. Or is she?
Well, based on my reading of other reexaminations under 07, I would say that she is relying on old stuff to some extent. But it is...
Oh, sure. You always look at the whole history, but she sees him on May 17th.
Right.
Right.
But it's fair to say that it is a new examination based on his current status as of the date of that examination, which I assume would have been probably summertime.
She says part of it deals with her description of his response on May 17th. So I'm just assuming that as of that time that she puts in her report, she's looking at him as of that date.
Yeah,
and, of course, you always look at somebody in a history.
I think that's a fair assessment.
So the way I read that sentence, but obviously I'm not sure enough, otherwise I wouldn't have asked you, is that, okay, as of November 29, 2000, on the basis of the material in the file then, which has just been completed, Mr. Chopius is back into the NRC, but that it doesn't affect his prior decision because as of that time, he would have been released under a supervised release.
Right. And I could see that as an interpretation of that order, except that from a legal issue standpoint. But on the other hand, even had he been released and we didn't have that appeal, the end result, if the trial court's correct now, is that he goes back. So it's certainly going to affect the way one looks at the legal issues that are in the case, even those that were raised by the initial determinations.
Your bottom line is, look, he's back in under full control and care of the institution. Therefore, the state got what it's wanted, so it can go home under this case. And if the defendant wants something more or different and wants to look at these 2 years or so, then this is not the appropriate case to do it in.
That's right, and I base that primarily because now we have a record, some of which is not currently before the appellate court, and if we go back and Mr. Schilpius chooses to raise all of those issues, which I'm fairly confident he will, we will have the entire record to look at. And I might say, in addition to that, we do have statutory changes which may affect some of those issues. I don't think it would affect the constitutional questions, but it certainly now, for instance, if this case were to recur right now, the judge would not have the option of commitment at the initial stage. So if once we start talking about supervised release for future cases, we're going to be talking about it in the context of 18 months of treatment at WRC. Now, that's not going to be the case for Mr. Schilpius, even on appeal in this case, on a different appeal in this case. But in terms of the viability of the issues he's raising in this case, they do tend to be somewhat unique because of the statutory changes.
Chief, may I ask one follow-up question? I have concerns about mootness. I understood the earlier part of your argument, though, to suggest that maybe this isn't moot because there is a potential for a claimed remedy, that is, the remedy of a appropriate remedy, maybe dismissal of the...
On the constitutional issues on double jeopardy due process. But see, that's, in my view, that's where even if this court were to delay, we would probably benefit from a decision by the United States Supreme Court addressing quite similar ex post facto double jeopardy claims in a Washington sex predator case.
If you don't dismiss, do you want it delayed? Is that the point?
Well, we're dismissing our appeal. When I say delay, I am anticipating Mr. Schilpius' appeal of the trial court's order below.
Thank you, Mr. Weinstein. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Hennig, representing Mr. Schilpius.
Sorry, this is just taking a minute. May it please the court, I'm Ellen Hennig, and I represent Sean Schilpius. Just so the court is aware, the person who's sitting with me at counsel table is Tom Wilmoth, who is the trial attorney. I asked him to come because I thought some questions might come up that we simply didn't, with the information in front of us, have the answer to. Why don't I start with that portion, because I do have some of the answer. The state in April filed a motion that they denominated a motion for reconsideration. As a result of the state's filing that motion, Judge Franke apparently asked them for some additional information. That was what led to the report from Susan Saxonmeyer.
Okay, what are they reconsidering?
They asked for reconsideration of the grant of supervised release.
Okay, and that's not under one of the 980s where you have authority to go in and...
There is no provision in Chapter 980 to reconsider supervised release. The reason they titled it a motion to reconsider, I suspect, is because there had been some discussion that you cannot revoke someone who's not actually been placed on supervised release. It's the sort of, we're way beyond the statute nature of this case that caused this to happen. Now, that leads directly to my position is that he did not have the authority to issue this order. And I would say that for two reasons. Looking at 808.075 subsection 4 subsection H, which authorizes such things as considering supervised release commitment under 980. I think that that is restricted to those items which naturally come up under the statute, which naturally come up under 980. If he'd already been placed and this had been pending and he had been, could the court have revoked him? Yes, I think under that provision it would have had the authority to do that. But I don't think there's anything in there that contemplates something other than something that's occurring under 980. And this did not truly occur under 980. It occurred under a grafted-on procedure because we were way beyond anything 980 provided for.
If there had not been this case pending here, would Judge Franke have had the inherent authority or some other statutory authority to reconsider his original 980-06 commitment order?
I see no authority to reconsider it as a reconsideration. That leads us to the next step, which is, could this have been a request for relief from judgment? I think it's very clear that civil rules apply. The problem is that's not what happened here. And I think it's pretty clear it's not what it was denominated as in the trial court. It's also pretty clear if you look at Judge Franke's decision that he was not dealing with a relief from judgment.
What
the reason I say
that, counsel, I'm sorry? Relief from judgment is what section?
Relief from judgment is 806.07 is relief from judgment.
Okay.
And when you do a relief from judgment, you look, there are certain factors trial courts are required to look at. There's no mention of any of them in this decision. And if you look at a case called Settlement for Personal Injuries for Kanicki, which is at 186 with second 140, it details those factors, and they're things like whether the judgment was a result of a conscientious, deliberate, and well-informed choice of the claimant, whether there was ineffective assistance of counsel, whether there was a meritorious defense to the claim, whether there were intervening circumstances. But you have to look at those factors, and it seems to me it's very clear that no one in the trial court was even thinking about those factors. So I don't think the court was conceiving of it as a relief from judgment. I don't think that the state was. I don't even think anybody thought of it in those terms. So I would say that there is no authority for the order that was issued here.
Let me just, for one moment, because I did read the 980 sections that are referred to in the 808. There are ways under 980 that the individual can get periodic reviews. And there are ways, and I don't know that I'll be able to put my hands on them right away, that the state can get review. But none of them fit here. Is that your position?
None of them were designed because no one contemplated you would have somebody who had been approved for supervised release but not actually placed there for 3-4 years.
Okay.
So
that
nobody ever even thought about it.
So it doesn't fit within the technical language here, the very language of the statutes that gives the state review. That's your principle.
Right.
I just want to understand that.
What normally would happen is the kind of review you would get if Mr. Schulpius had been placed on supervised release and just flat out placed on supervised release is the state would have had to come in and say, okay, he's screwed up in some way, let's revoke him. Well,
Ms. Hennig, did anyone object to Judge Franke proceeding? There objection on the record?
Yes, there were some on the record objections to his proceeding. Exactly what the nature of those were, I think Mr. Wilmoth would would be able to tell us better.
Well, the problem we have here is we just don't have that record.
Right.
And the question that you might address, and Mr. Weinstein might address, is whether or not in this proceeding we can, you can ask that record to be called in, or whether that we're off into, you know, a different case.
Justice Abramson, excuse me, I'm having a hard time hearing you through
right,
those
sorry.
Files. Could we possibly move them?
No problem.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Well, the point is, can you bring those records in? You can always supplement the record. I mean, I shouldn't say always. You can make a motion to supplement a record. The question is whether that record is still a record of this case or whether we're into a different case if we start bringing in the trial court record here.
Normally, I would say we'd be into a different case. The only thing that gives me pause here is the way that this particular order is worded, where the judge himself in this particular order is making reference to his own due process findings and saying that this may be an additional piece of that. So I'm not sure how that influences it. I haven't even thought it through.
Right.
Now, as to, and I'm going to take this, I think, a little bit out of order because I can't remember what the order of the questions were, quite honestly. Sealing versus Young. I think that that's the easiest piece to take next. There are four claims that Mr. Schulpius currently has before this court. They involve ex post facto, due process, double jeopardy, and procedural due process. Sealing versus Young has absolutely no effect whatsoever on any substantive due process or procedural due process claims, because that case simply doesn't present them.
Well, I think it did in the prior proceedings. It might have, but the court did not take
that. The court did not take that part. It is clearly, if you look at, and the only thing that's really available to look at this point is the briefs and the transcript of that oral argument, they restricted themselves to the question whether a statute that was constitutional on its face could become punishment in some way. So it is restricted to that question. It is also restricted. I think it is very clear that if Mr. Young wins in the United States Supreme Court, Mr. Schulpius wins. Now, what that means in terms of relief we can discuss later, but he wins. If Mr. Young loses, it depends on exactly what the court says. If the court says there is never any time that it could turn into punishment, then it's true that Mr. Schulpius would lose on the ex post facto and double jeopardy claims, but only as to those claims. No effect on the due process claims. If the court says, yes, there are some circumstances under which it can be punitive, but we don't find them here for Mr. Young, what effect that has on this case depends upon what factors they're looking at, because the two cases are in very different posture procedurally. Mr. Young is up there complaining that he's not getting adequate treatment, basically. Mr. Schulpius is saying, I'm not getting what the statute contemplated, and our argument, had we been standing here on the merits, would have been, we're looking at the statute as though a piece of it has been written out. And it's a key piece. It's a release piece.
You started off this section of your argument saying that sealing has no impact on this case whatsoever. And yet, then a minute later, you seem to, I thought I heard you say, if Young wins, Schulpius wins.
No, I think what I was saying, and if I misstated it, I apologize, it has no effect on the due process arguments at all. Because
but
it doesn't.
It may on ex post facto
and double jeopardy. If I misstated it, I apologize.
And you have a relief problem here.
And you have a relief problem here that's a little bit different. And that leads me directly into mootness.
Before you get to mootness, you said that the Young case, the Sealing case, doesn't affect because it doesn't deal with either procedural or substantive due process. But doesn't that case, the challenge in that case, deal with the conditions of confinement? And as I understood, your challenge dealt with the lawfulness of the confinement.
Yes, and that's why I said the two are procedurally extremely different postures. And that's why I can see one scenario under which there's only one thing I can see the United States Supreme Court saying, maybe two. There are two different things the Supreme Court could say that would have a clear impact on this case. Anything short of either of these two would still leave us figuring out what the exact impact was. The court could say, yes, these conditions, and if the conditions of lack of treatment can do it, certainly unlawful confinement ought to be able to do it, make it unconstitutional as applied in ex post facto and double jeopardy. Now, I think it's also possible that if they said it never affects it under any circumstance, that it's possible, but I think even there you end up wrestling with, is this case in the same kind of posture as that case?
So you end up with, it could affect you.
It could.
And it may have language that would be helpful or detrimental. So in light of that, why shouldn't we just sit tight and wait? Otherwise, what's going to happen? We rule on the case. U.S. Supreme Court rules on the case. Either the state or you come back and say, hey, relook at this.
I personally think the strongest argument I had if I were doing the merits is the substantive due process.
And what does substantive due process mean?
Substantive due process claim that the failure to have release here, the failure to follow the statute, I guess that's procedural as well, the failure to provide for things that this court required in order to uphold the statute causes the statute to no longer satisfy substantive due process as to anyone for whom the supervised release provisions will have been effectively read out of the statute. I could see waiting if we didn't have a very practical problem here. And the very practical problem is this keeps coming up. Sprosty is really another permutation of the same type of problem. The basic problem is that there are no placements. In this record that's before you, there are no, there's a statement that there's no placements in Milwaukee County. That's in the record site 51. Milwaukee County has no residential facilities that will accept sex offenders. We also know from this record, the record that's actually before the court, that there are at least, well, it's never been clear to me whether when they say four, they mean four, including Mr. Schopius or not. There are several other people sitting there in the same posture. Given that 4 years isn't enough to get here and everything that happens intervening, I don't know what it is it's going to take to get it to this court again.
Are there people sitting on initial 980 commitment orders authorizing or specifying supervised release who have not been released, or people sitting on subsequent reexamination supervised release orders?
I am aware of one person sitting on an initial supervised release. The other two people I'm aware of, I'm not sure which situation it is, but I'm aware of at least one other. And given that there are increasing petitions for supervised release, if the problem is that there are no facilities, we're going to continue to see this even at that stage, because the stage of it doesn't change the problem that there's no place to put them.
Except for the fact that the statute now specifies that supervised release is no longer an option on an initial commitment order.
But it's still an option under petition.
Right.
And at the petition stage, you end up with the same practical problem.
Right, but in a case with a different procedural...
Right, but what I'm saying is that if, you know, it's taken... Judge Franke initially, when this motion to dismiss... And that's what it was initially. And that's the other reason that it's not moot, is because I know the state's position has been that I cannot argue remedy because we didn't appeal from the order. But when the state started arguing that the judge gave the wrong remedy, I think the state fairly brought it within this lawsuit. Because one of their positions is, well, even if he was right, it's the wrong remedy. Once they started arguing that, I think remedy is very much in front of this court.
I'm going to just try and pull you back.
Sure.
You're arguing, if I understand it, on the issue of the U.S. Supreme Court case, that you have a that you will be affected or might be affected by ex post facto and double jeopardy. Since due process is not in it, you won't be affected on that.
Right.
Your due process argument, and I'm going to phrase it a little differently, and maybe I will be wrong. Your due process argument is, look, there's a statute here. The statute provides for supervised release. They don't follow the statute on supervised release. That is a due process argument under state law.
That's a portion of it. That's not the whole thing, but yeah, that's a portion of it.
Enough now for us. Okay. So that's why you say don't wait for Young. Then it seems to me you moved into mootness. It's not moot because, one, he's affected, and two, you've got other cases in the pipeline. Is that right?
Well, I don't think having other cases in the pipeline is directly, it's not moot as to him. I think what I'm suggesting there is, I think we went from mootness to why should this court, and it's all gotten mixed together, why should this court keep this case anyway?
That's right.
And I think those two got mixed together.
Okay.
But it's not moot because remedy has been an issue, and one of the remedies asked for was dismissal outright.
Now, you asked really that he just be released, period.
Right.
What does that do? Is he released on so the department can pull him back in if something goes wrong, or you just want him free and clear of 980?
Well, normally, when a statute is unconstitutional, it's unconstitutional, and that means that there is no statute as to that person.
Even when it's in application, unconstitutional as applied?
I was not able to find any cases where we said it's unconstitutional as applied, but we're going to rework the statute to apply it so we can only as to that person. I have to admit that was the portion of the argument I was working on Wednesday when I finally got the call that this had come in. So I have not thought that through as well as I would have liked to, just because of circumstances.
I understand that. I don't know the answer, right? I'm just asking you as to...
But
did you ask for 1983?
Pardon?
Have you asked for...
There is no pending 1983 suit at this point.
And if we went into a 1983, I assume the record here is not going to be good enough to deal with that.
I honestly don't know.
Okay.
I have done some 1983 work that was so many years ago, I don't even remember what the requirements are.
All right,
so we've discussed Sealing versus Young, mootness. The other thing, that the reason I think it's not moot is because I'm looking at the language of what Judge Franke did here. And it's very clear to me that the order here continues. And then we say, well, how does it continue? And because he specifically entered his order on Wednesday, still subject, however, to the decision and order requiring release entered in this case on October 27th.
How can that be possible, though? Subject to one order that says he must be detained in institutional care simultaneously with an order that says he must be released. That's a physical and legal impossibility. Is it not?
Well, I think there are a couple of ways of interpreting this. One possibility is that he's saying, well, as regards to 980, you can hold him, but because it's been unconstitutional, that's it, he's out. I mean, one trumps the other, and which way it trumps. You're assuming that the supervised release one trumps. It's not that clear to me that that's true. It may be that the other one trumps what he decided here. And that seems particularly to be likely that that's the way he's thinking when you look back, and I think it's pages 5 or 6 of that opinion, where he says it would be fundamentally unfair if unlawful confinement were to cause behavior which is then used to justify lawful confinement. Nevertheless, and he's referring to the behavior, is relevant to the assessment of risk. Any unfairness must be addressed as part of the due process analysis, which led me to order his release earlier in these proceedings. He seems to be suggesting that what has happened here is an additional due process violation that should result in his release.
Ms. Hennick, how can you say that when you read the last sentence of the conclusion and order, as required by SCR 70.15, a form order for such commitment will be separately entered? Doesn't that indicate that he's going to sign an order for commitment to WRC?
Well, he's clearly going to sign an order for commitment to WRC, but whether that, which of his two orders that he's issued trumps is not entirely clear. I mean, I personally wish this had come down 2 weeks ago and we could have had time to move in the court and say, what do you mean, Judge Frankie? Unfortunately, circumstances are obviously where it did not allow that. I think that the other way that you can look at it, though, is it is continuing so that if Sean Schulpius is ever granted supervised release on a petition, the other way to look at it is this order immediately revives if they can't place him within the 21 days. He doesn't have to start over going, okay, we keep extending. And that would be the other way that this order stays in effect, would be to say it's out there, and if they place him on supervised release and spend another 4 years, I think they could spend another 4 years looking, they can't. Well, that would be the other way to construe this.
I don't understand the prior order, and maybe you can help me. Judge Frankie finds the statute unconstitutional as applied.
Right.
Nevertheless, the guy stays in.
Well, that happened.
Why is that?
Because he stayed the order pending the appeal of this case. And if you look at the order, which is in the record,
right,
granting that, he said he was doing it despite the fact that he didn't think they could succeed on the merits, but that under case law, and I do not remember the name of the case, under case law, he believed that the presumption of constitutionality, the case law said that that presumption was enough to require him to grant that stay.
Well, then can't we use that to explain this last sentence? It's further ordered that he be committed because he has stayed his other order. But it's still subject to the decision in order requiring release because it's unconstitutional.
Right.
So
and that would be
unconstitutional, but he stayed the effectiveness of his own decision.
Right.
So since he has stayed it, it's now before him again as to what the remedy to Mr. Schulpius is, that is a release or institutionalization. And since it's stayed and he's not releasing the guy,
right,
he's going ahead and treating it as if it's all okay. But it's not okay under his first order.
Well, I think that that makes some sense. That's why I'm saying that I'm not sure which order actually governs when all gets said and done. The release order, which currently is not in effect, but is still out there, and he clearly intends to still be out there.
Or well, it's in effect, but it's stayed.
But it's stayed.
The effect is stayed.
And when that stay is lifted, it would be my position that what governs is not the reconsideration of the supervised release, but that earlier order. And he's clearly not killing that earlier order. He's not reconsidering that earlier order.
I interpreted that phrase, and who knows, but tell me, I mean, I interpreted that phrase as that he put that in there because he knew this case was pending and he didn't want his order to, he wanted to leave open the possibility of this case because he knew it was here. Now, you know, I don't know if that's correct or not. Is that, tell me.
If that is true, I find the timing a little odd. Because if that was what he was trying to do, he could have, Mr. Schulpius was sitting at the Wisconsin Resource Center. There was no immediate need to issue anything. He had waited since early October. He could have continued to wait for a decision from this court. You may be right, but I think it's equally possible that I think it's quite clear he didn't mean to make this moot. But right beyond that, I think it's unfortunately not totally clear, although I would say that he was trying to keep this alive, but it was simply stayed. Are there any further questions?
Now, we dealt with, what about the authority of the court?
Okay. I thought that we had dealt with the authority of the court.
You don't think it does, not under 980, and doesn't fit under
right.
The judgment. So that's the three issues, the authority of the court, the mootness question, and the question about the United States.
Right, and I don't think that it is moot. I don't think that anything he did here can moot it out.
Well, suppose you should prevail in the sense that we go ahead with this case. Now, suppose you should even prevail that he ought to be dismissed ultimately, that this is unconstitutional as applied. You could then still bring in 1983. I mean, that your immediate remedy now is you just want him released.
Right.
The other remedy.
And I cannot get that, and it is, let's put it this way, I'm not sure that I cannot get it, but it is difficult to get into 1983, which is more traditional monetary damages.
Thank you. So this really is a release case.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. I guess the first thing I'd like to address is the substantive due process claim. And it seems to me that the substantive due process claim in this case is nothing more than the statutory claim in this case. And if we follow the admonition that we don't reach constitutional questions if we can resolve them on statutory grounds, we don't reach the substantive due process claim in this case, because if holding him for 4 years is a violation of substantive due process, it's also a violation of the statute, which the statute requires, and this court has said that once the court enters the order for supervised release, he's entitled to supervised release. So we have, it seems to me, the very same problem that the United States Supreme Court is wrestling with, is if the statute says one thing and the administrators do something different than that, does that create the constitutional problem, or is it merely a statutory claim?
Yeah, the difference, though, is the U.S. Supreme Court is not going to interpret the statute of the state there, whereas that is an issue here.
Well, the United States Supreme Court, looking at the transcript of the oral argument, was very concerned with whether or not when administrators didn't provide adequate treatment, and it is true that Mr. Young's claim is that he's not getting adequate treatment, where Mr. Shopia's claim is that he should have been placed on less restrictive...
In accordance with the statute.
Right, in accordance with the statute. But in both cases, the essential claim is the administrators are not doing what the statute says. And in Mr. Young's case, he's arguing, because the administrators are not giving you treatment, this makes it punitive, and therefore it violates double jeopardy and ex post facto. And several of the justices asked, well, why isn't his state claim that he isn't getting adequate quick treatment, and by the way, he does have, in a separate action, a pending 1983, Mr. Young does, why isn't that case adequate to address the fact that he's not getting treatment? The way that's come up in this case is the remedy of dismissal appropriate? And Judge Franke, even if you say he's subject to his order, the case isn't dismissed under his prior order. Mr. Shopius is still subject to commitment.
Well, but he stated, is that...
That's right. But he's only stayed the release. So even if Ms. Heineck is right, and the ultimate... Judge Franke's earlier order is ultimately affirmed, Mr. Shopius doesn't get out of being committed. It would take something more from the appellate court than just an affirmance of Judge Franke's order to have him completely out from under Chapter 980. This court or the Court of Appeal would have to hold that Judge Franke erred by not granting the motion to dismiss.
And we granted.
I'm sorry?
And we granted, if that's the way the court would hold. Why can't we say heard, but we'll grant it?
Well, I suppose that would be a possibility.
Because if it was unconstitutional or the statute wasn't followed, that might be a remedy. And
right.
This may very well be a remedy case, depending
on
whether the
rules...
It could
be, and it probably will remain so, even if you dismiss this one and it comes up again. On the other hand, if the basis for that unconstitutional claim is double jeopardy and ex post facto, we may be looking at it again after the U.S. Supreme Court decides Mr. Young.
You think this court ought to call for the record that was made in relation to this new order?
I think that it would be better for the whole case to come up rather than try to supplement in a piecemeal fashion. And the reason I say that is, again, if we look at the case as a whole, if Judge Franke erred in the first instance in granting supervised release, which we haven't addressed because appealing from a non-final order, it was my assessment that that wasn't before the court. That was not before the court because that's not the order we appealed from. If that is an error, then what does that do to everything that's happened since then, which includes the motion to dismiss?
Well, and isn't that the functional effect of Judge Franke's order?
Well, I think...
The most recent one, he said, I was wrong.
I think the practical effect of it is that, yes. From a legal standpoint, I think what it does is it gives a final order that's going to bring the entire case up before the court rather than just this more narrow non-final appeal. And in my view, that's one of the big reasons why this case ought to be looked at as moot, sent back for appeal of the entire case and addressing all the issues in the case.
Well, I've changed my question then. You think we ought to just bring up everything?
I think so, yes. I think
deal with it now.
And send it back, and I'm sure that Mr.
Why do we send it back? Why can't we handle it here?
Well, because, first of all, I think there is a serious question about whether the entire case is before, all of the issues in the case is before this court, since we're on appeal from a non-final order. And we could say, well, yeah, we can supplement it with the stuff that's come later. If we do that, why don't we supplement it with the stuff that come earlier? And if we do that, don't we have the whole case? And why shouldn't we just say, let's dismiss this appeal and let it come up again? At least at this point, we have a determination by the circuit court that Mr. Schulpius shouldn't be out of institutional care.
Right, so the whole reason for the constitutional challenge, which is the heart of what's before us, has evaporated.
In my view, that's right. In my view, that's right. I'm sure Ms. Hennick would disagree with that.
I mean, there may be, you know, a damages claim for violation of Mr. Schulpius' civil rights for the 2 or 3 years that he sat detained, perhaps illegally, as stated by Judge Franke, but that's a separate issue. We don't have that in front of us.
Yes, it is a separate issue, and even that is subject to Judge Franke's, the correctness of Judge Franke's initial determination, which we don't know how that's going to go either. I'm sure that
is before us.
I think what's before you right now and what we attempted to bring before the Court of Appeal was whether or not a statute which has been held by this court to be a civil statute in nature could be converted to a punitive criminal statute by virtue of the fact that the administrative agency could not find a supervised release placement. And that, as I read Judge Franke's initial memorandum in the case from, in the order from which we appealed, was the primary holding. And in my view, that's why this is virtually identical with the Young case. It is true that the remedy, or that the the activity of the administrative agency in Young is different than the administrative activity here. But essentially, what we're saying is, can an administrative agency, by its implementation of the statute, convert an otherwise civil statute to a criminal statute for purposes of double jeopardy and ex post facto?
Thank you, counsel. That concludes our argument in 000095, In Re Commitment of Sean Shulius. And we will